The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Serval Resources is one of the newest names in mining on the London scene. Robin Birchall is the man in charge. He joins us now for an update on what's been going on. Robin, very good to see you. It's been a while.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on today. Always a pleasure to have a discussion with you. Looking forward very much to answer a few questions for you.
Yeah, I'll be happy to pose a few questions to you. So tell us about Serval then, first of all. Let's kick off with the main event. What's happened?
Okay, so Serval is a copper exploration and development company. It was I was asked a little bit over a year ago by a couple of my colleagues in the industry, well-known mining entrepreneurs, Neil Herbert and Ian Stalker, if I had time for an executive position. I said, absolutely, I do. I'm looking for something. And they said, can you help us sort out this company? I said, yeah, absolutely. I've got time to do that. And I had a look at the company and said, what am I allowed to do? And they said, well, Robin, you can pretty much do whatever you want. I said, okay, I have a thesis on copper. Been looking at copper asset a couple of years, or maybe not that long, 12 to 18 months kind of thing. I've got some ideas. And they said, go do it. And so we spent last year reforming the company, you know, reorganizing the board, adding staff and getting the initial assets in. And, you know, and then over the Christmas period and rolling into this beginning of this year, finalized the transaction and finalized the admission to AIM and raise some capital so that we can go forwards and execute on our program. So that's basically the story that happened in the creation of the company.
So before we go on to talk about the assets, I suppose it's worth emphasizing that Neil Herbert and Ian Stalker, who you mentioned in passing at the top of the conversation there, very big names in mining, really, aren't they? Very experienced and a lot of successes under their belts.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, so they're not the only two. We have an excellent platform with this. The assets are coming from another very good friend of mine, colleague, Philip Richards. So he's one of the key shareholders in the private company vending to us. I've done a number of things with him and made him significant amounts of money. He's a very strong supporter. They will be a large they're going forwards in the company. And then the final one is Adonis Pouroulis and the Pella Group. He and I have known each other a very long time. I actually helped him with the creation of Toro Gold when I was back in the investment banking days and corporate finance here. And I spoke to him probably in about November or something like that. And he just said, look, Robin, what do you want to do with the company? And I said, look, it's a 3 to 5 year plan for me, trying to build it into a $1 billion business. We've had a few goes already. We've got a lot of experience now. We've got a good team. I've got good people on the board, directors who can help us take this forwards. And he said, perfect. That's what I wanted to hear. I don't have a copper team at the moment. I want to have exposure in the copper space. I'm going to back you alongside these other guys as our vehicle to build a copper developer and producer over a 3 to 5 year period. And I said, great. That's exactly what we're looking to do. We've done that in the past, but this time we've got the right commodity. We had some other more tricky commodities in the past, ones that don't have a terminal market and things like that. So yeah, very excited. Got great backing. Got the team that I want to have, like a bunch of guys who, for example, our CFO, Richard James, he and I floated a company of his some years ago when I was corporate financier, and he called me up in December and said, I've seen your presentation. I think this looks really excellent. Do you need a CFO? And I was like, absolutely. And I don't think I could get somebody of your caliber if I went out into the market. And he's like, look, I like you. I like what you've done. I like this project. Can I join? I was like, absolutely. Done.
So it's a ministry of all the talents then. Adonis obviously be able to help you with your African perspective. He's got a lot of experience in that area.
Yep. Well, and that look, we have some very good partners in Namibia, and which I haven't done as much work in the past. We've done lots in Botswana, guys in the department who previously worked for us in the field, in projects that we've run. So we have great connections there. That's why we've had you know, a fairly smooth process in renewal a number of the licenses over the last 6 months. We've been effectively operating the company for the last 6 months, or maybe 9 months now. So we've done all the exploration that needed to be done for the renewal of some of the licenses, because a couple of them had gotten a bit stale. And those relationships we have obviously are very helpful. They completely trust us because of the work we've done before. We say we're going to do something, we do it. And then in Namibia, we've got, you know, through Adonis, but also through Ian and Neil from their previous stuff there. And also through Philip and Andrew Bennett's, the Bennett's family, we've got some excellent connections there, which have been very useful.
So it sounds like, from what you're telling me, Robin, that a bunch of very serious people in the mining industry said to you, we'll back you, Robin. What's your plan? And the plan that you put together is Serval. Is that a sort of accurate characterization? Is there more to it than that?
Well, there's a little bit more to it than that. I had a gold thesis, and we had some success with a gold company. We had this view that gold is inflation-proofed, and that has proven to be sort of true. It's gone from 1,600 to 5,000, whatever it is, 4,800 or something now. But copper is an industrial metal, I don't know how much you think about the 70s and 80s, but the process in the 70s and 80s of the build out, particularly in, you know, Canada, the U.S., of suburbs alongside the interstate highways and things like that, you have a huge demand for copper and electrification. Now, we've had an amount of that in China, and it's coming in India. But, you know, then we have, you know, as time moves on and new technologies come, then there's a continued and different demand for copper. And that's obviously new energy vehicles and the whole data center. And that makes it somewhat inflation-proofed. It rises, you know, it doesn't suffer from inflation like, say, nickel or cobalt or steel inputs and things like that, because they suffer when building is down and recession comes along. Those kind of metals perform less well. But copper seems to be able to handle inflation quite well. So that was the thesis. And then I was very lucky that Neil and Ian approached me and said, well, we've got a vehicle, you can do whatever you want with it. And I already had this ready-made position that I was wanted to do copper. I wanted to do something that I didn't have to explain to people what it was for, what it was used for. And, you know, there are some, you know, it's more difficult because it's well known. You need good assets. You can't sort of hide behind the inferior assets like you can in maybe zinc or some other things like that. But, you know, that's where the other bit of it, which is knowing Philip and having made a lot of money from him in the past, he more or less delivered to us on a platter these amazing assets in Botswana and Namibia. And that you only get really through experience.
How did he get them then?
They acquired them like 10 years ago when copper was $6,000 a ton or $4,500 a ton. They had a vision pre-COVID, which the copper was going to be important. They were just a little bit early on it. I mean, if you look at the structure of the deal, that's why it's so heavily to equity. They're not, you know, you see these other, we looked at stuff in Zambia and people want cash out. They're not really interested in the cash out. Yes, there's a small upfront amount, but that's really just to help them, you know, run their little business that will hold the shares. They're not really in it for the cash. They're in it for the equity upside and are really geared towards the equity side of the business. And you know, that's excellent for us. They're coming in as a significant shareholder, and they're putting a person on the board. So, you know, it's a great addition. Yeah, I mean, we're a confluence of events. I mean, obviously, more recently, it would have been nice to have been in the market 4 to 6 weeks before we were, but quality project has shown through, and we've been able to raise the money we need.
So let's talk about these assets then, Robin. Why don't you just kind of list off, you know, what they are and what their potential is in, you know, as many words as you think is required.
That's there. Yeah, sure, no problems. Well, look, Botswana, the Kalahari Copper Belt, not as well known as the Central African Copper Belt, you know, Zambia and DR Congo, but that's mostly because it's they're all blind, as you can see in the picture behind me. It's all covered by sand. So it was, you needed good geophysical techniques, and those probably were developed in the late 90s, early 2000s, and only became significantly better with mobile units and especially now with drone, to be able to shoot tighter spaced geophysical methods relatively inexpensively. And then you need to work them together. So if I just give you a very short lesson in that. So the first thing, the first pass you do is you'd walk across our flay here, and you do every 50 meters, you do a soil sample. So you're looking for this cone where there's a slightly higher, between 20 ppm inside the cone and 1 or 2 ppm outside the cone in the sands of copper. Once you've done that, then you would walk it with a series of geophysical techniques. MAG, EM, AMT, things like that. And they have two things that they do. One is they can either see the sulfidization in the contact, or they can see the difference between the sandstone and the shale. So when you add all three things together, that's where you go and drill. And that was sort of perfected by the Australians, I would say, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. And if you remember 2011, I think price copper was 5.5 or something, or 4.5. So they did it at a very difficult time, but they perfected the techniques. It's a well-developed, now there's two large operating mines producing over 100,000 tons of copper. Relatively underexplored. There will be at least 8 to 10 more mineable discoveries that will occur there. So that's Botswana, excellent infrastructure, all that kind of stuff. Not very far away from the main roads, power, all the things you need. Namibia is slightly different. It is also a sedimentary hosted, and it's also a redox boundary, so a sandstone unit in the shale, where the pH changes and the copper drops out. But it was relatively underexplored because of the national liberation struggle, or the civil war that was fought between the independence forces and the South African Defense Force up until the early 90s. And it was closed military district, so it was very difficult to get in there. You need a permit. So not a lot of exploration occurred until the mid sort of 2010s. Teck went in there, did a relatively large program. But again, as we talked about, the price of copper was pretty low. Teck got itself in trouble in coke and coal in Canada and exited most of its international exploration and just left. Rob Friedland is influential in our industry. And one of the things that he really has had a huge impact on was people looking at sedimentary hosted deposits as opposed to chasing porphyries, and with his Kamoa-Kakula. And, we have had significant interest from the majors. Obviously, I can't name who they are, but, if you could think of a major, they've approached us and signed an NDA with us to look at that Namibian land package, because everybody's looking for, it may not be one large deposit, but a cluster of decent sized ones, but the grade is, above 1%, maybe above 1.5%. And they've all become quite excited about that because of what we talked about in the industry, with new energy vehicles and AI and just a regular demand for copper. There's a structural shortfall that has been pulled forward by Kraskop's force majeure. And then also, we've seen, unfortunately, for Kamoa-Kakula, they're going to be a bit short next year. This is affecting on the supply side, and then demand side is significant pickup. So, yeah, we're in two excellent jurisdictions for making some significant discoveries.
So you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, Robin, that you want to make a $1 billion company. How are you going to go about that? You've got these copper targets. Presumably it's in the nature of the targets that you have in mind that you're going to find something big.
Well, you don't actually need that big. If you look at something like Marimaca, these are not huge anymore. And if you look at MMG in Botswana, their deposits there. It's a bit hard to do the see-through valuation. I tried to have a go at it, but they paid $1.9 billion for it in 2023 or four, I think it was. Their market capitalization today is about 18. So maybe you attribute 4 or 5 to Botswana. We only need a quarter of that or a fifth of that. So, you know, and in production, it's 30 to 50 million tons at 1.5, probably does it for you. And that's not actually that big. And we certainly believe that, you know, we're in a sort of closed period at the moment, waiting for the admission on the 27th, because we've got the prospectus out there, but we've got some work that we've done, and we certainly believe that in Namibia, our Matapati, which we talk about in the prospectus, it has the potential to generate that. And I, you know, spoke to our GO, and I said, well, if you were to arm wave, you know, can you get me 30 to 50 million tons? He's like, yeah, I think so. You know, there's enough. It what we talked about, which I think is fine, you know, it's in the prospectus and the CPR's strike length of 1.6, maybe more than that. You know, what is it? Arm wave 1 to 3 to 5, depth probably down to 200 meters. And the only thing that's really a question mark is how wide is it? And then in that zone, you have some faulting, right? So you have a fault this way or whatever you have. If you have where it folds, if it folds everything up and makes it thicker, you know, then you're going to have more tons there. And that's what we are working on at the moment, is doing they didn't really have enough manpower to do regional mapping. We've regionally mapped it. They're working on it at the moment, and it'll be out after the 27th. But yeah, we certainly see the potential for 30 to 50 million tons. And that's a good starter to get you to, I don't know, at least halfway, more than halfway to a billion. And then it's really about the execution on a PEA and a PFS and a DFS and all that. But we've done that before. I don't want to say it's easy, but, you know, I don't know what the right metaphor is, but, you know, we stood on the tee and hit golf balls down the middle of the fairway before. You know, it might not be an easy course, but we know how to do it. We're just repeating what we've done in the past. And so, you know, we think that we've got the skill base to be able to do that. And once we made the discovery, we just move it through the development phases. And then it's about capital. And, you know, if we've done well in the first phases, people will provide us capital. And they have in the past. We've proven that we don't waste it. You know, we don't fritter it away these are not lifestyle companies we've run. They make investors a lot of money.
Yeah. So has there been any drilling already, or is it?
There's kind of a proto wireframe in Namibia. That's why I can sort of speak a bit more intelligently about it. It's not really. The drilling was mostly, I would say, done for license retention purposes, and not. I mean, you can't say it wasn't done for exploration, but was more targeted at making sure that you could hit copper, have discovery, show that to the ministry, get extended, right? Which is great. You made the discovery now, but now you need to go back and be a bit more systematic about it. As I say, this, you know, this is extension along. It's in the sort of foothill of the small mountains that they have there. And you just have to follow that all the way along, map it all geologically, which the guys are doing now. And then you go back, maybe shoot some IP, I think, there in Namibia, and we'll probably trench a little bit, and then that's how you decide where you put your drill collars, and then we'll drill in the second half of this year. And that, you know, if we're lucky, that'll be an MRE.
Right. So, I mean, second half of the year, that by then you'll have the, you know, the funding in place, the listing in place. Tell us a little bit about the amount of money that you're bringing in with this AIM listing, and about the AIM listing process itself. How's that been?
The AIM listing process, I mean, I've done a lot of them, and the AIM has become, in the middle of our transaction, more flexible, which is a change from the past. So they were reasonably tight in a regulatory sense, and a bit inflexible, shall we say, but we had planned the transaction in a way that it would make it as easy as possible for them at AIM. So even though they've made some adjustments, it hasn't really impacted enormously on our process. It just meant that, you know, like when you submit the Schedule 1, maybe in the past we waited a bit longer, but they came back to us immediately and they're like, tick, 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 all fine. Like they're trying to be helpful within the rules to, they need more companies back on the market, right? Yeah. So that process has been good and we've enjoyed it. It was a lot of work though, because even though it wasn't a reverse takeover, we still had to audit all the financials for the target, even though they're completely irrelevant, but it's part of the rules. And, we had to produce a competent person's report, which that's useful. You know, people can read that and get an idea of why we think what we think about the jurisdiction. But it is an involved process, and it is, I'll tell you what, launching. Don't launch when the U.S. has decided to have a war of choice in one of the most difficult regions in the world. You know, I'm pretty sure they got it done. It was a lot of arm twisting and a lot of help from our friends to get it over the line. And we got the minimum that we needed, the $3 million, and that's all allocated to the company or whatever, $3 million or something. That's enough to us to do all the work that we need to do over the next 18 months. And I just commend my team. They worked round the clock and extremely hard, and pulled some all nighters to get this thing done.
And remind us of the listing date then.
Listing date is 27th of April. We have a 3-week EGM period. EGM's on 24th. We've got the irrevocable, so that should go through in a fairly straightforward fashion. We've got all our major shareholders vote in favor of it.
Yeah, well, it's going to be the next big copper company. Could be a big thing for the AIM market.
I think so.
I was just going to say, you know, the AIM market has kind of had a tough time of it in recent years, especially as regards mining, but, you know, across the board. But it does seem to be showing certain signs of life. So you've obviously put your faith in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, London is still one of the most important capital markets in the world. It's, we don't need to get into any politics, but it has not helped itself in a number of ways. Hopefully there's some sense on that. And you also need better markets for the mining space, that is. And we've seen better markets. You fundamental underlying commodity prices have been better and the demand is there. So as soon as people are making money, I mean, the big problem, I had a friend in one of the brokerage houses, and he put it beginning of 2024, maybe end of 23, he did a review of all the mining funds and the specialists, how many there were in 2012 or something, and how many there were then, and what their amount of capital they had under management. And it was, I mean, it's been decimated. If you look over 2025, particularly the end of 2025, the specialists have made good money. They're not returning it. They now have the ability to invest in new and what we think like us undervalued opportunities and help the mining sector grow. And the generalists have arrived. And, you know, I have this little anecdote that I tell people. I mean, I think it was Meta invested $24 billion in the metaverse for something that really didn't come out to be an awful lot. And Zijin, their 10-year capital bill to grow themselves into one of the integrated majors was just about the same figure. And that tells you the difference in the amount of capital between us and the technology space. You can spend an enormous amount of money in the technology space, and that would build you all the copper mines you need, you know, for the next 10 years kind of thing. Once they arrive, that's extremely helpful for us in terms of the capital we were required to be able to move through these phases and get into development and production.
I mean, I remember a statistic somebody told me many years ago, actually. I think at the time Microsoft was capitalized at more than the entire mining sector. So you do get
Correct.
These crazy, crazy yeah. comparisons.
Yeah. That's right. Well, and it's just access to capital. So once we, again, avoiding politics and if at all possible, the focus, the tariffs that the U.S. placed on, you know, countries around the world caused the reaction from China about rare earths. And all of a sudden, the industry or industries that required those metals realized how exposed they were and how little investment there had been and how much they needed to make investments directly and not rely on, you know, other partners who close off the supply. And that has led, particularly in the US, biggest capital markets in the world, to interest in the mining space. And we get incomings from people who you never got it from 2, 3, 5 years ago, saying we want to invest in the mining space. And, you know, that's incredibly helpful to us. I mean, I'm on the board of another company as well in the uranium space, another quite interesting space. And we've got a lot of interest out of the US for that company. And, I believe that's why the four guys who've decided that they want to back us, you know, in the past 3, 5 years ago, their capital was constrained. They've done well recently, and now they want to back us, and that'll attract, you know, like the Jim Mellons and other people like that who are more generalist, I would say, than specialist. And we're starting to see that. Yes, of course, it's a bumpy period right now. It's difficult, price of oil and the rest of it. But, you know, I don't think that's part of the cycle. That's sort of, you know, unconnected to the cycle.
Yeah, you mentioned that the generalists are coming back, and that's always a key moment, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you and I have been around long enough. The younger guys have never seen it. You know, the guys like I have Max Denning on my board is a really smart young guy. He's never seen a bull market, actually. Wow. Really. Yep. A little blip in 22.
Yeah.
For the mining space. He's never seen it. And, he, you know, I keep reminding him, like, don't sell too early. You know, like, yeah, the tide actually goes up. You go really long way up when it goes up. You'd be surprised, you know? So, yes, of course, you can harvest a little bit out of your portfolio, which is what the specialists are doing, and then reinvest it somewhere else. Then your specialist knowledge becomes more valuable, because now that prices are rising in a general sense in the mining market, you can apply it. And you can, like, for example, us. I mean, of course, the CEO is going to say this, but I think we're ridiculously undervalued. And that valuation gap, when valuation gaps close, they close really quickly. All of a sudden, they're not undervalued. And then it's incumbent upon me and my team to deliver extra value on top of that, you know, to build the company, to make the discovery and all the other things. But just on what we've got, I feel like we're significantly undervalued.
So after the listing happens, what's the sort of short-term news flow going to be, or short to medium-term news flow going to be like? You're going to come onto the market and then start saying things, Robin, about what you're doing on the ground. What's it going to be?
Yeah. Well, I've got to be quite careful, because I can't say anything right now that would mean that I need to put out a supplemental prospectus, because that's just a waste of money.
Yeah.
But it's basically, it's outlined in the documents that we distributed for the fundraising. So we have the Namibia and the Botswana programs, which basically it's exploration in key areas. We've done most of the kind of remedial keep our license conditions current kind of work already. We have a little bit to do in Namibia in 7079, which we'll go and do immediately. But that's really it. All the rest of the licenses, all of the kind of remedial work that we needed to do catch up stuff, we have done already. We have some results from that, which we'll publish after the 27. We don't have the final analysis of that, but it'll be out shortly. It's the geophysics and stuff. But however, that's done. So then we can really move into the more interesting stuff, which is in Namibia. It's the Amatapati prospect, really. We are going to generate, this is about 4 or 5 other interesting prospects. We will take a bit of a closer look at them and decide whether or not we want to accelerate any of them. But the Amatapati has got most of the drilling on it, or the most of the useful drilling on it. So we will be doing, well, we've started the work already, and we'll get that out after the 27th, and then we'll just roll into the next phases of that exploration, looking to prepare ourselves to drill. I don't know. I'm talking to the guys at the moment about it. We're rejigging our budgets now that we know exactly how much money we have. Probably best if I leave that till after 27th, but you know, we'll all be down there in May. And then probably be looking to get mobilization contracts done in June or something like that. And then it just depends how long mobilization takes. Industry's starting to get busy. People have also forgotten that when this capital is provided to the industry, all of a sudden everybody wants to buy services, and the services guys don't have enough equipment. So you need to be fairly quick on that. Otherwise, you end up waiting. I already know. I was talking to a mate of mine who was gold company. He was like, "How long is it? How long are you waiting for assays?" Now they said 3 weeks, and they're like, "Well, it's now it's 8." You know, and then you can't move to the next phase until you've seen your results, right? Like, you know what you want to do, but you need to know exactly where you're going to do what you're going to do next, because you can't do that until you've seen the actual results. So all that stuff starts to pile up and delay you a bit. But and then in Botswana, it's geophysics. A little bit of soil sampling, and we'll hit 232 and 2474 hard as quickly as we can. It's relatively inexpensive work, and we have a pretty decent sized team that we can mobilize in Botswana. And quite frankly, the young guys, they enjoy it. Like, to them, it's almost like, you know, holiday camping, because they get to be in the bush and it's really nice, and the work is, it's hard work, but it's fun. And you get results pretty quickly. So they, as the young man, they really enjoy that.
Are you guys interested in picking up any more assets, or are you happy with the portfolio that you've already got?
Well, again, I can't say an awful lot until the 27th. But yeah, we've been in discussions with people. We have to wait until after the 27th, get that done, and then we'll be able to announce anything that we've got ready to go. But yeah. We always want to add to organically to what we have. If there's, like, you could imagine, this is not the case, but you can imagine if you look at our map in Namibia, there's a little tiny gap in between. You know, if we could get that, we'd add it. It's that kind of stuff. So there's nothing enormous that is going to change the direction of the company. It'll just be incremental stuff that either help us with our in-country partners, or improve our land position and give us a greater opportunity of maybe more strike length or something like that. But yeah, absolutely. We are in those discussions. I have people badgering me all the time. Now that they see that we've got some money, you know, I've got all these emails I need to answer and NDAs to sign and things.
I guess you need the people to execute when the luck comes your way.
Well, that I'm not worried about, because we've done quite a lot of this before. You know, Lohan and I have drilled 100,000 meters. We work really well as a team. I've got Richard, the CFO, who I've worked with before. He's very good at, you know, you don't want a CFO who's Dr. No, right? You can't just say no to everything to keep the money in the bank. But you need somebody who says, are you really sure you need this? What about this other? These are our 5 priorities. Rank them, I want to know what your ranking is, and you need to explain it to me so that I can then agree with you that we should spend them in this order, right? And that's quite important. That's how you have cost control, because you have to spend money. You have to spend it on different things. And, you know, a lot it's holistic. You need to do this kind of stuff with you, right? It's really important. You have to get your message across. You can't just be in a little black box in the ground doing good work. You have to also be able to explain to people what you're going to do. Well, once you've done it, why you did it, what the results were, and why they're good or bad, right? You need to do that. That's part of the business. You need to get to be in London for meetings. You have to do the stuff at SMI in Switzerland. You have to go to Indaba and do all the meetings. So you need to see the investors, need to talk to the industry. On the other side of that, you need to give as much money as possible to the guys on the ground doing the work in the ground. Because if you don't spend the money there, you can't find anything. And you need to be able to, and then you need to have some, like, it's, I'm lucky, I have Luan, need a guy who's always got his eye out for making sure that this is done, you know, I don't want to say cheaply, that's not the right way to put it, but without any waste of expenditure. You know, if you want quality, we've had that experience in the past. We decided to go with a less well-known driller. The rig wasn't very good. We had a lot of downtime. It ended up, we got less meters for more money, right? So that's not efficient. It looked cheap up front. Now we don't do that. As you know, now we have, particularly in Botswana, maybe we know who we want to use. We know they're not the cheapest, but they don't have downtime, and they don't have wasted meters, and they don't lose to rods and things like that. So in the end, you get exactly what you wanted for a price that was competitive, and that's really important.
So you've got everything lined up now, Robin. I suppose one imponderable that you can't really control is the copper price. What are your thoughts about the long-term copper price and where it's heading?
Well, you know, there's this old sort of saying or adage or whatever it is that all you need to do is go bust last. That's all that matters. You just need to be the cheapest and then don't worry about the price. The price will do whatever it is. You can't control that. So what we want to be is at the very bottom of the cost curve. And I think that, you know, and I can't remember what, if you'd have to have a look and see what MMG is producing. It's in their filings. If $1.90 or something, $1.95 a pound or something like that, you know, and whatever, you know, $5 something, you know, Botswana is not expensive to lift the copper. It's not known in Namibia, but I don't expect it to be wildly different to that. So we will be close to the bottom, maybe being the first quartile, ultimately. It's why we've chosen those jurisdictions. There's a number of factors that go into that. You know, you can have an amazing deposit, and if it's, you have to build a railway to get there or something like that, your effective cost of C1 or whatever it is, you know, all in sustaining costs is going to be a lot higher. Well, you know, we don't have to worry about that. The infrastructure that's in place is excellent in both countries. We don't need to build a power line, you know. Even in Namibia, where it's quite a remote region, luckily for us, the Ruakana Dam, which was built under apartheid in, I don't know, the late 80s, the power line runs maybe 50K. The main power line runs about 50K away from where the deposits are. And because the main power line is there, all the smaller 32 and 66 KVA lines are already there. So, you know, whatever it is, $1 million a kilometer for putting in a power line, well, we don't really have to spend that. That's great. And that's what drives your overall cost down. Having said that, you know, obviously I picked copper because I thought it's going to do reasonably well over the midterm, and it's performing nicely. It's been a bit bumpy recently, but that's, I'd call that macro kind of stuff or financial flow kind of stuff and flight safety and things like that. But the general outlook and picture is for it. Originally it was for demand to exceed supply, you know, over the short midterm, like 1 to 2 years. With Grasscop and now Kamoa-Kakula having events that are beyond their control and reduction of production, that supply demand is now, which is why it went from 8,000 to 14,000. I mean, these markets are not very big, and they react very quickly to a small amount of excess demand, and price changes rapidly because you can't do without it. You can't substitute. You know, you need, can't you? So it's quite hard to substitute copper.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they call it the bellwether of the global economy, don't they? And I guess that, you know, that's one of its basic investment cases, actually, that is so crucial for everything.
Yeah, so that's why, I mean, that's why I keep saying it's actually what matters in copper is how good your deposit is, right? And we're lucky. I mean, obviously, we haven't totally proven them yet, but we're not somewhere where, you know, where the system isn't known or proven. These systems are well known and proven. And in Botswana, there's, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 operating mining sites. There's 2 companies, but we don't need to worry about what the metallurgy is. We know it. It's the same everywhere in the basin. So that is proven. We know exactly what the cost is going to be to produce it. We know what's going to happen in the PFS. We don't have to invent any of that as we go along. And other places, you do have to. Or you have to build infrastructure. I mean, you know, Kamoa-Kakula, they refurbed that dam, that's, I don't know, $300 million project or something, to refurb an entire hydro dam, divert the river and all the rest of it. Well, we don't have to do any of that. The power line coming from the main power station in Botswana runs all the way to Khansi. Why? The World Bank wanted to electrify the rest of the country. And the two mines said, we'll stump up some cash for it because we want the power, right? So it's there already.
Are there any big copper mines in Namibia at this point?
Well, in the carbonate platform, there have been in the past, but that is, so it's sort of part of the Central African Copper Belt, but it's different. It's in the carbonate platform. They were mined, so there's Sumab Combat and something by Grootfontein. They're slightly different. They're not the sedimentary hosted reduction boundary, but it does mean that the rest of the infrastructure, you know, the smelt capacity and the port and all that kind of stuff is in place because there has been copper mining previously.
SUMEB had, you know, it's had its issues, hasn't it, over the years?
Correct.
So it's not always straightforward.
No, well, but that's in the carbonate platform. We're not in the carbonate platform. It's different.
Okay. So anything else going on then, Robin? I mean, we've talked around Namibia and Botswana in, you know, in some significant detail. And obviously the listing is the next big thing you guys have got ahead of you. But is there any other aspect of the Serval story that we haven't really covered?
Yeah, you should. I mean, everybody should just keep their eye on Ivory Coast. It's relatively more early stage, but it is really interesting. There's some, well, obviously I worked in Ivory Coast before. I'd seen what we had in that other company. We had a very long haul of copper with a gold credit. And obviously that's why I wanted to pick up these licenses. I was very interested in that. I mean, those targets there, if they were to ever come to fruition, and look, I think we'd probably have to end up JVing them because they'd be enormous and it would be, you know, hundreds of thousands of meters of drilling, but it's very, very interesting. It's why we originally went back and sampled for gold, because we think that there's like a lot, along with the University of Western Australia and the University of Queensland and the WAXI initiative, the West Africa Exploration Initiative, we think that there's probably IOCG systems there, and that's really interesting. And those are, you know, that's the fourth kind of way that you can, a big major like Newmont can play copper. They either go porphyry, they go sedimentary hosted, or the few IOCG systems around, and then it's VMS, but VMS tend to be small. So that was why Newmont originally got in, because they're a copper gold company. So we picked that up. Just watch what we're doing there. We'll quietly get on with our exploration, but we may have some pretty exciting things that come up from that. You know, just don't think of it as an addendum. It's really quite interesting.
Right. So plenty to be looking forward to then from Serval. I think that pretty much covers it off for now, Robin. It's been really great talking to you. I wish you all the best with the listing, and obviously, you know, in your work programs that you've got ahead of you as we move through the year.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.